those of you who are hockey fans, especially from the United States, you probably recognize that one from the mid-1990s. That was the original NHL Tonight theme song, the recap show that used to air on ESPN2 every night. I tell you, I was quite the fan. It was awesome. Basically, you had Bill Pito before John Buchagrass, and then, of course, the more famous duo, John Buchagrass and Barry Melrose, who we'll be talking about pretty extensively during this episode. But before we get to all that, I just want to say good day, everybody. How's everyone out there in hockey land doing? I'm Danny Lambert, and this is From the Point. It's been another great week, and we all know that the target date for the return of the NHL action is in the pike now, and that's awesome. So I think everybody's ready for NHL action to return so we can watch some great hockey. I mean, I'll tell you right now, I'm skeptical that January 13th will work out, but, you know, minor miracles, stranger things. So positive mental attitude, eh? Regardless, we'll get to see hockey in about a month, hopefully. But for now, I'm happy to help fill your hockey void with another look this week at a great hockey book and a great hockey story. So one of the trademark things of hockey in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s is pretty much awesome hair. I'd say the hair game is every once in a while tries to make a resurgence, but it was never as good as it was in those three decades. There are a ton of great examples of great manes from some of the greatest to put on skates from that era. Bobby Orr started to get a pretty good flow going in the late 70s after sporting that buzz cut in the 60s. Bobby Hull had his version that was helped by a pretty expensive hairpiece in the 70s, but if you look at him in the 60s, that was all natural. And of course, one of the funnier parts about that hairpiece is it getting torn off in a brawl, but that's a whole other story. But perhaps no hockey hairdo is more famous than that of the mullet. The mullet's rise in the 80s was crazy. The idea that you could just let the back hedges grow wild while grooming the rest of the yard seemed to be a revelation to many hockey players. Perhaps it was the advent of the helmet and the fact that you could grow your hair out the back of your helmet that made it so popular. I can't put my finger on it, but it seemed to be the follicle thing to do. I never wanted to get one, but definitely a lot of people did. I'd name all the players that sported the mullet back then, in the 80s and the 90s especially, but yeah, we'd be here all day, and you're probably already tired that I occupy your time for an hour. So I'll let it lay. But now, if I switch it to coaches who sported the mullet in that era, there's really only one you got a clue into. That would be the former bench boss of the Los Angeles Kings, Barry Melrose. I could still picture that dapper up-top pomade slick-back look with a bunch of hair hanging off the back of his neck while he was patrolling the Kings bench between 1992 and 1995. Not to take away from Barry's hairstyle, but those Kings teams were great. Gretzky, Robitaille, Curry, Blake. He had some serious talent on those teams. But Barry was a great hockey mind as well, and he seemed to be the glue that helped the Kings get to the Stanley Cup Finals in 1993. Although the rest of his time would be largely disappointing in Los Angeles. It was a long road for Barry to get to that place behind the Kings bench and eventually to become one of the best commentators on TV today in the hockey world. He's always had hockey talent, but it was never elite. Still, for me, it's the fact that he played in the WHA, NHL, and mostly in the AHL that makes his perspective so good. He knows the struggles of all the players, all of them, not just the superstars, and he's never forgotten them today while on TV or when he was a coach at the NHL or AHL levels, even as a junior coach. Still, for me, it's the goofiness of Barry that I loved over the years. He's always been spot on with his commentary, but quick to cut a joke in that thick Western Canadian accent of his. That's why when I saw he wrote a book, I jumped at the chance not only to read his story, but to read it from his own words, and it didn't disappoint. So let's get to the warm-up and get this week's tilt started as we review Dropping the Gloves Inside the Fiercely Combative World of Professional Hockey by Barry Melrose and Roger Vaughn.
There's an old saying in hockey, you look good, you play good. So you need to be rocking some serious flow. Something I proudly did on the ice and behind the bench in the NHL.
the haircut itself, what is it called?
It's kind of the shebang, man.
The shebang.
We got everything going.
But the roots of hockey hair culture are here in the North Star State. This is the land of 10,000 locks.
So what you heard there was a segment from E60 that Barry did to interview some of the kids from Minnesota. If you haven't noticed, during the Minnesota State Hockey Tournament, there's a big player introduction that they do before every game, and the kids love to sport some seriously awesome hair. And as we just discussed, Barry's another player who's got some seriously awesome hair. I also appreciated hearing him talk a little bit about how that tied into his playing days and stuff. But as a Minnesotan, too, it was also just awesome to share some good things about the high school tournament with everybody, because it is a special time back home. So, and to hear from some of those kids is pretty cool. But I did want to start out the warm-up by just saying that to this point, we've really only told stories about players. And while we discuss Barry's playing time here, I also am just excited to do a profile about a coach and a broadcaster, because that seems to have its own nuances and special topics that we're going to get into. So today's episode should be slightly different and pretty special. So for me, being a U.S.-based hockey fan and growing up in the States in the 90s, I can honestly say that Barry Melrose is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, voice of my formative hockey years. Sure, my first time seeing him on TV was as the Kings coach, but it was the gig that he fell into almost instantly after that that I seem to remember most from my childhood and even today. While ESPN could care less about hockey these days, in the 1990s, when they had rights to air NHL games, they cared a lot. They had great play-by-play voices with names like Gary Thorne and Tom Meese, but when it really came to who you think about who the voice of NHL hockey on ESPN was and is today, easily you have to say Barry Melrose. Through his spots on SportsCenter, and especially for me, it was his time on NHL Tonight on ESPN2 that aired every night back when ESPN had hockey in the 90s, first with co-host Bill Pito, and then more famously his current partner in crime, John Buchegross. That's how I really remember Barry the most. Even though, like I said, I did get to catch the tail end of his coaching career. But for all of those comments that he's had on air, they've always came with a lot of great insight that stems from years of slugging it out to stay relevant in the player game and then doing so in the coaching ranks. And what makes this book a good one is it's all the stories behind that worldview that makes Barry one of the best NHL pundits today. Not only do you get an insight into just his life, but he tries to explain the context behind the different parts and add things back to relate to today's game. So not only is the reader in for some good stories about Barry growing up on a farm near Kelmington, Saskatchewan, and then playing junior in Kamloops, and then moving to the WHA, and then on to the NHL and AHL, you can expect some spot-on comments about the state of the game at the different particular moments in his life, which he ties back into some of the bigger issues that you still find in today's game. Then, if that wasn't enough Barry commentary, you get the last two chapters and afterward, where he's mission complete in talking about his life and simply just pivots to complete thoughts on changes for the game, and then the best of different categories like funniest people he's met in hockey. And finally, in the afterward, he updates the book with a few more topics specifically. Also, it can't be stressed enough that it's the best hockey stories from players who weren't exactly superstars that make the most difference in our understanding of the game. Many times the autobiography game is filled with the stories of players who don't have to take the hard roads like Barry did. For example, one of the things that we all get into that we'll get into a bit more later is how Barry's perspective gained from bouncing to and from the AHL and NHL made him more aware of what it meant to send a guy up or call them down, or send a guy up or call them down to the minors. If you only get stories of hockey glory, you don't know the whole arc of what the game is. So if you're always constantly just reading about somebody who had it easy and had an easy road to the NHL and then instant success while they were there, what are you really learning? Sure, Barry went to the finals as a coach of the Kings, but that was about it. And I think it serves him well in his analysis on TV and in his ability to write this very honest and awesome book. Certainly as well, I can say that this was an easy read. The text isn't too big, and it's only 234 pages. So it's a get in and get out and don't belabor the point type of book. It's a complete recounting of a hockey life, but it doesn't make you bored at any point. So let's get into the first period and talk about Barry Melrose, the player, and how he came to travel a road to the NHL that was a different experience for the players of today, but not of really a different experience for the players of the 1970s when Barry made his foray into the professional ranks. Stand by, the first period's up next.
Oh, hello. Didn't notice you there. I was just doing some light reading.
Any reading you've ever done is very light.
The National Hockey League Official Guide and Record Book, 2015. Barry's name is in it.
Yes, it is.
For all the wrong reasons, as you can imagine. Actually, you were just telling me, weren't you just saying you have among the records for the most penalty minutes in a single playoff series, American League?
American League. I was Adirondack against Moncton.
Yeah.
107 minutes in one playoff series. That's a lot of trippings.
Was it? Wait a second.
Like, so 52, 53 trippings.
Roughly.
And I think I told the referee off too, and I got me a 10.
Really? Was it a best of three series?
It was a best of seven. It was a long, hard-fought series.
Who was on the other team?
Joel Otto, Brett Hull.
Right.
Jay Miller.
The Jay Miller?
The Jay Miller.
So I'm guessing you were on the ice against Miller and not so much against Brett Hull.
And a little guy for Boston. It was because it was Boston Calgary Prime team. A little small forward. I can't think of his name.
Stan Jonathan?
No, but played in the 80s for Boston. Can't think
they
of
had a lot
right.
of those guys.
Yeah.
Or Ken Linsman.
That type. Also I assisted on the first goal in Winnipeg Jets history.
Yep.
So I'm in a lot of records.
Yep. You scored Ray Bourque's first goal, sort of.
Bounced it off me, yes.
That's amazing. Yeah, remember we found the footage of that in the highlight
reel? You're like my sons on YouTube. You can't find anything of me doing good.
Right.
They can find everything of me doing bad.
There was the Maple Leafs debut, shorthanded goal.
Fight and with
fight.
7 seconds.
Right.
And then a shorthanded goal.
Right.
And in the third period, some fans stood up behind the bench and yelled, "Hey, Melrose, what are you going to do tonight?" And Dan Maloney stood up. And that's why I love Dan Maloney.
Right.
Stood up, looked at the fan, because in those days, the fans were right basically in the bench.
Yeah.
And told the guy if he stood up again, Dan Maloney's going to go back there and kick crap up.
Right.
And Dan Maloney would.
Right.
So from that day on, I love Dan Maloney.
Right. And from that day on, you were probably booed in Toronto like everybody else.
Yeah,
right?
Well, everyone's booed in Toronto. Good players are booed in Toronto. Can you imagine what they do to bad players in Toronto?
I'm going to tell you right now, that's an awesome segment. And if you didn't laugh, I don't know what's wrong with you. That was Steve Levy and Barry talking about some of Barry's more funny slash, dubious records in the NHL, AHL. I just love those segments, and there's a couple more of them out there if you want to check them out between him and Steve Levy that are just awesome. But what I think comes through, and it really should teach you a lot about Barry Melrose, is just his self-deprecation and ability to laugh back at his career kind of is just a – average Joe kind of NHL player. And I think so that's always, like I said, shaped his perspective, but at the same time makes for a lot of the humor that you see in Barry today. So recommend checking those out, but hopefully you got a little bit of a preview into what Barry's playing days were, which is what we're going to talk about here in the first period. So Barry's road to the ranks of professional hockey started out much in the same way that most kids from the prairies were used to in the 1970s. Growing up in Kelvington, Saskatchewan, he played on his local lake, which he describes as more of a pond, and then he moved to play for the local house team, and after that he was recruited to play in a neighboring town of Weyburn for the Red Wings in the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey League, or SJHL. With Weyburn, he started to gain a reputation as a strong 6'1", defenseman at age 17, and it looked like Barry was going to keep moving up the ranks quite easily. At this point, as well, Barry mentions in the book getting a scholarship offer from different American universities, more specifically Minnesota Duluth, but not even considering that because at the time, the NCAA was not a way into the NHL. Only a handful of college players that made it to the big show, and as Barry saw it, Junior offered him the best way forward. Funny how things change, considering 65 NCAA committed players were selected in the 2020 draft to include three in the first round. But in the 1970s, if you haven't ever read up on that, it was considered pretty much a dead end if you wanted to make it to the NHL. It's here in the book that he takes time to explain to the reader the facts as he saw it and sees it today of junior hockey, that it's really a business. For some people who may not be as big a student of the game, it might seem like junior hockey is simply a development league and that the player comes first. And for those of us that are a little more attuned, we know that's not really true. Sure, education and safety are pushed, but the end goal for any junior team is like any other sport. They want to make money for the franchise. And add to it the fact that the kids are usually 14 to 20 years old makes for an environment where development of hockey skills can't be the only thing that junior players get. Barry explains this and adds that being far away from home and the idea that the club could trade you or just cut you at any time gives plenty of examples of that from his junior time and how that could be very stressful for the young kids. He says he saw teammates and whole families wrecked by things like being traded, and here offers his first bit of insight that it made him very attuned to what moving a player could do personally, which he took to him when he coached junior later on and then up the ranks in the AHL and NHL. So after 2 years in Weyburn, Barry had played good enough to get noticed by WHL scouts. Unlike today, there was no draft for major junior, just lists of protected players in which a team puts you on their list, and it was pretty much a first spot you go to type of proposition. In the case of Barry, the first people to put him on the first team to put him on the protected list was New Westminster, who promptly traded his rights to Kamloops. Barry describes having to get used to the tougher brand of hockey in the WHL. At this time in the mid-70s, hockey was being dominated by the Broad Street Bully types and their copycats, who started to value the blood and guts type of hockey over the skill. We discussed that before when we discussed the Canadians and Soviets game on New Year's Eve in 1975. Much of the same things apply here. It basically ended up, though, where we haven't gone is haven't really talked about how it really trickled down down to the junior ranks as fighting became an emphasis and you started to see more and more of it come out because the teams were picking top draft picks from the fighter classes as opposed to the skilled classes. So it was definitely a very lucrative way to make your way up into the NHL. Still, Barry learned quick and was adjusting to the physical style of play. Kamloops and Barry had a strong season in his second year there, and as a result, he got drafted by the Montreal Canadiens in the second round, 36th overall. It's a decently funny story because the draft wasn't on TV, and Barry had been out working on the farm and had to get driven to a phone to have his agent tell him he was drafted that day. It's a good story from the book when you read it. But Barry had a dilemma that started brewing from that drafting. Well, he was glad to be drafted and so high by a great organization like the Habs. He knew he wouldn't have a chance to play in the NHL for quite some time if he signed with Montreal. This was mostly based on the fact that when GM Sam Pollock wanted to sign Barry, he offered him a three-way contract, which meant he could end up all the way down in the IHL, which, for those of you who don't know, was the level below the AHL back in that day. And basically keep him further from playing in the big club in Montreal, which Barry was pretty weary of right away. Still, they owned his rights, but like many of the players in the mid-70s, he had options because of the WHA. And for Barry specifically, the Cincinnati Stingers selected him in the third round of the WHA draft, so he had a choice. Cincinnati offered Barry a one-way contract and more money, so it wasn't an easy decision in the end, but Barry decided to sign with the Stingers and played most of that season with the Stingers and their AHL affiliate in Springfield, Mass. In the WHA, Barry found the circus of the Rebel League fun and challenging, and luckily for him, the Stingers were a solid club with good management and great players. not all WHA franchise had that kind of stability. Barry spent three seasons with the Stingers and started to play a strong physical defensive style of hockey that made him a solid starter in the WHA as he started to build up regular playing time. It needed to be noted that the Stingers were so good that at that point that they're in their last season, they had two very good future Hall of Famers that played with Barry that he mentions in the book. And I thought this was really cool too. He actually played that last season in Cincinnati with Mike Gartner and Mark Messier. So not too shabby, even for WHA standards. Barry was there at the end with the Stingers when the WHA-NHL merger happened for the 1979-80 season. Like many other players who shucked NHL teams for the WHA, Barry found himself in a bit of limbo when after the merger happened. They were integrating all the players back into the NHL structure and therefore reverted back to the NHL franchise. Those players would revert back to the NHL franchise who owned their rights. There was a draft to dope out the remaining merging of the WHA and NHL players into the different teams. And Barry ended up having his rights eventually, though, traded to Winnipeg, who signed him to what he thought was a fair contract. And now he was in the NHL like he'd always dreamed, so things seemed to be going well for him. While Barry thought the Jets had offered him a fair contract, and he didn't mind the franchise's management, he just found that the Jets of the post-merger NHL years were not very good. Barry would play a season and about a third with the Jets before being sent down on waivers to the minors. But he'd never report to the Jets' AHL affiliate because the Maple Leafs would snatch him up off the waiver wire. He'd finish the 1980-81 season with Toronto and would pull together some good play that kept him with the Leafs for the better part of two seasons till the 1982-83 season when he was sent down to St. Catharines in the AHL for a spell to give younger players a chance for ice time. And Barry explains that that helped him play a little bit better when he eventually returned to Toronto, so he really didn't have any ill feelings about that. Still, that next season before the 1983-84 season, Barry would sign a new contract with the Red Wings as they offered him a one-way deal and the Leafs were now offering him a two-way contract. Sure, Barry knew the Wings would send him down, probably due to just the way he was being almost age 30, but he needed to make sure that the money was fair and that it was a steady stream, and it looked like the Wings would be paying him at the NHL level even if he was with the AHL team, which is what that one-way contract really meant. When describing his time in Detroit, Barry explains that he was getting older, losing a step on the younger guys, and not able to fight like he had, which had helped fill in the fringes when his playing got a bit behind. So that meant, as expected, he spent most of his first year with Detroit and then a bulk of the rest of his playing time with the organization, bouncing between the Wings and their AHL affiliate, Adirondack, playing mostly in Adirondack as opposed to Detroit. Still, Melrose spent four seasons in the Red Wing organization before calling his playing career quits after the 1986-87 season. But it would be his expertise in the minors and learning about the game in Adirondack that would be key to the next phase of his career that he was about to embark on, which was coaching. Pretty logical. And that's what we're going to dive into and talk about that next phase when we get to the second period, which is up next.
No, we didn't reach the goal we had, and we set our goals very high, but we made a lot of strides here, and we're becoming an excellent organization, and we've got it now, so our young players, our Sidor, Zidniks, and Blakes now expect to win, and our older players now have turned the corner, and that's when you get an organization that expects to win, then you've got something.
People will look back at the stick measurement and say everything turned there. Did that call turn the series?
No, that call turned that game because it put them into overtime. They beat us in overtime. And then, the two other games at home, we lost in overtime. We had to win those games. That's winning and losing. Once you get into overtime, you have to win some of those games, and we didn't do that.
What did you tell them in the locker room after the game?
Well, it's a bittersweet thing for us right now, for me as a coach, because I lose very hard. I'm very competitive. But as a coach, I just feel blessed that I have this group and have had a chance to be with this group. It's a special group that you don't have all the time as a coach, that you genuinely, it almost turns into a love thing. And then people, I know people at home, they think they can't believe that, but as a coach, and we played 120 games this year, these guys, the Huddy comes back and plays tonight when he shouldn't have. Taylor played two games when he shouldn't have. Conacher plays when he shouldn't have. You see Gretzky night after night. You see the kids night after night. It just becomes a special relationship between a coach and his players.
Any doubt you're back here in this spot in a very short time?
I don't think so, because with the three young guys in defense, and we've got some young guys in the wings, and I foresee all our older guys, maybe this will spark them and even make them better. The Currys, the Gretzkys, the Sandstroms, all had the best years. Granato was a force. That guy, seeing that guy play every night. So, and we'll make our team better this summer.
All right, Wayne Gretzky's season. No doubt he'll come back. Do you think he's revived his career?
Yeah, Gretz went through a tough time this winter, and I think the last 3 months, he got the fun back. He was jumping tonight. He was great tonight, and he's got a smile on his face most of the time now, except when we lose. And he'll be back with a passion next year.
All right, congratulations on a great year.
Thanks, Al. Thank you very much.
Back, Gary.
They like to say in Montreal, the cup is back home. Everyone who cheers for the Canadiens considers this home for the cup, the Forum, and the Montreal Canadiens have won it. It has been a delight.
So what you heard there was an interview with Barry after the 1993 Stanley Cup Finals when the Kings lost in Game 5, basically just kind of talking about what he thought the future of the Kings were and what their situation was. And as he says there, he feels like the future was pretty bright, especially with a lot of young players coming up, like Rob Blake coming into his own. But as we know, the story really didn't end up that way, as Barry's Kings team started to going to get into a bit of a rough patch after that. But that's really what we're going to talk about here, is Barry Melrose, the coach, what it was like for him to make that transition from a player into being a coach, and what the road was to get to the Los Angeles Kings, and then a little bit what it was like to be there. So while he was in his last season with Adirondack, Barry started to realize that his playing days were probably over, as being in your 30s and squarely in the NHL with part-time NHL fill-in assignments was a tough way to go. It was out of this realization that he decided to take his first step into the professional ranks of coaching. He made a deal with Bill Dineen, the then head coach of Adirondack, to become a playing assistant coach, and it proved to be a game changer, as Barry learned the tradecraft of coaching while still making decent money as a player. It was at this point that Barry knew he could retire as a player and stay as an assistant in Adirondack, but he had his sights set on having his own team. As he puts it, he kept his ears open and saw an opportunity to jump right in as a head coach in the WHL with Medicine Hat. As fate would have it, the Tigers were a good team, and they were just coming off a Memorial Cup win, so that could vault him to a lot of early success, which Barry thought would be a great situation, so he jumped on it. And he also got help from Dineen with a strong recommendation, and so Barry got the job. At this point in the book, Barry does an excellent job of telling you the foundation of his coaching philosophies, and starts to really talk about what makes him tick as a coach. I really enjoyed this section, especially because Melrose covers ideas that are central to any coach and how he wants to run his team. How to discipline, how to motivate, how do I develop talent, since he would be coaching in Major Junior as opposed to elsewhere. He had to make sure that he not only could nurture talent, but also develop it. He explains also that he had to navigate a unique situation, and that the players there saw him as their mom's, quote, new boyfriend there. When they didn't know what to make of him, they were first a bit resistant. So, you know, he's basically trying to explain to you that he's going to a really good established team of Medicine Hat, who was wondering, you know, what his system was all about, whether or not they could buy into it. So he had a bit of a hard time there. But as he would say, he had the players to build the fast team that he really wanted to do. He basically thought about what team would be hardest for him to play against, and so he made his team like that. But he was having issues reaching them at first, a lesson that would serve him well later when he would head to L.A., when he would start coaching the Kings. But even there in the WHL with Medicine Hat, he was learning. He was learning what it was like to get to a well-established team with a bunch of superstars, even at the junior level, and then try to reach him. Still, in Medicine Hat, Barry's biggest challenge was that he was coaching kids, not men. He had to adjust his style to fit their abilities, and he found that sometimes the schemes that he would introduce for different systems were just unable to be executed by the younger players, as they just didn't have the talent. Most of all, he said it was the challenge of being a father figure and a guidance counselor in addition to being a coach. The teenagers of the team needed support, and as Barry would put it, he was up to the task, but lucky that many of his issues were not the difficult ones that he needed to solve. But still, he had to put in the extra work, and he found it to be both rewarding but hard at the same time. Still, after a rough start, Barry and the Tigers went on to a second-half roll and won the Memorial Cup that year. For the next season, though, Barry made a move along with the then Medicine Hat GM Russ Farwell onto the Seattle Thunderbirds at Farwell's request. Farwell had just gotten the job in Seattle and wanted to bring Barry with him. In Seattle, Melrose found a little less success, as he said. The team was not as talented, and he was trying to reverse years of what he called a losing culture. He just said it wasn't able to be something that he could do in just 1 year. And once again in Medicine Hat, though, he really highlights how perhaps he made his biggest impacts by being more than a coach to his junior players, as we know is something you hope all junior coaches will keep in mind as they shepherd these young teenagers into being responsible adults. Basically, you're supposed to teach them hockey, but you're also supposed to teach them life at the same time, as they look up to their coaches at that point in those teenage years. By now, it's the summer of 1989, and a great situation presents itself. The GM of the Detroit Red Wings, Jimmy DeVellano, came calling with an offer to Barry that could not be refused on both the professional and personal front. The head coaching position on his old team in Adirondack came open, and since he had done such a good job as an assistant there in his two head coaching stints, and he had done so well in his two coaching stints in the WHL, the Wings wanted Melrose to be back in the Red Wings family. The AHL was also a stepping stone to a good NHL job, and since his family had also lived in Glens Falls with him when they were in Adirondack, everyone in the Melrose clan was excited to go back as well. Barry mentions here, though, that the Maple Leafs had offered him an assistant job with the big club, but he knew that Adirondack would be a better situation both professionally and personally, and besides, the Leafs of the 1980s were not very good, as we all know. Adirondack did not disappoint for Melrose, though. He found a young, hungry, and talented team flush with lots of prospects, which was a side effect of the years of those horrible Red Wings teams getting to pick high because of the bad big club, definitely stacked the AHL team with a lot of talent. Once again, Barry having the talented team, he garnered quick and awesome success as his Adirondack teams would go to the playoffs all three seasons he coached there and won the Calder Cup in Melrose's last season in 91-92. It was at this point that Barry's life would change significantly, as he got a call that summer in 1992 by the LA Kings management, who had been given permission to speak to him about their head coaching vacancy. The issue here is that as much as this was an opportunity for him, Barry wanted to stay with the Detroit family and thought he had a path to being Detroit's next head coach. The Red Wings also made Barry seem like a valuable part of the family, as Mike Ilitch himself, the famous owner and founder of Little Caesars Pizza, called Barry, urging him not to speak with the LA management during any part of the interview process, and basically Barry that he would have the head coaching job in Detroit after the current head coach left. That was how much the organization thought of Barry. But in the end, Barry did meet with the Kings owner, Bruce McNall, and was reassured. The Kings were interested and excited for him to be their next coach. The Kings made an offer, and before Barry accepted, he called the Red Wings management, who just couldn't guarantee that he'd be the next coach of the big club in Detroit, which made his decision a little easier, but still hard to accept the job with the Kings in the end, knowing that it would change his life. LA once again was a great situation for Barry to walk into, just like he had in most of his other coaching positions to this point. The team was made up of the right mix of young talent and veterans to include Gretzky. They were a team on the cusp of something good. Still, heading into that first season in 92-93, it looked like the Kings might be in trouble. Gretzky was having serious back issues that caused him to sit out until January 6th of that year. But still, the Kings were winning even without Gretzky, as Luke Robitaille led the team to a 2014-5 record until Gretzky's return. After Gretzky returned, they actually didn't play quite as well, but well enough to make it to the playoffs. And that playoff berth would be a special one, as the Kings went on a great run to get to the Cup Finals, but lost to the Montreal Canadiens in five games. It looked like Melrose and the Kings would be winning quite a lot from that point, but as fate would have it, the Kings would miss the playoffs in the next two seasons, and Melrose would be fired before the end of his third season with the Kings after a 13-21-7 record for the better part of the 94-95 season. Melrose is quick to note that this was just the way things went in the NHL, and that most coaches should really only reliably count on having about three good years with the club anyways. So now Barry's out of work as a coach, and as he said it, it really didn't affect him all that much. He just knew it was part of the business. He understood it to be a part of the game, and he was relatively accepting of his fate. But once again, that fate would have something great in store for him, as the next thing, and perhaps the career that he's held the longest, was only one phone call away in that spring of 1995. We'll get to that phone call in the next phase of Barry's career, up next in the third period.
No treats here, guys. I got something better. I got hockey stats. I love hockey stats. Nick Boynton, leading the NHL in plus-minus for the Boston Bruins. New captain of the Bruins, Joel Thornton, unbelievable young player. Mary Lemieux, 23 points in 10 games. Think of that. That's unbelievable. Minnesota, second-best power play in the NHL. What do you think of those things? Mary Lemieux's unbelievable. Rozov, Kovalev, Gabrick. Lucky night, kids. I don't have candy for you. I got something better. I got NHL hockey cards right here. Darren Pang, that's his rookie card, buddy. He's got hair in that picture. That's very rare. Right here, Ray Ferraro, just like him, shorter than the rest of the cards. That's a specialty item right there. Brian Engblom, great defenseman. Billy Comman, things like that. No. Come back. I'll give you Barry Melrose card. Winnipeg, Jets, Toronto Maple Leafs, great defenseman. Come on back. Sorry, but I got no candy, and I gave away all the hockey cards. Is that an LA Kings jersey? Man, I used to coach the LA Kings. I'll tell you some stories about the LA Kings. What do you think about that? Kelly Rudy? He was my girlfriend. Come on back. It's not that bad.
Man, I should have got into the Gretzky stories quicker.
Oh, boy.
Things we do for art.
The youth of Bristol will never be the same. That boy was visibly shaken. Did you bring the LA Kings sweater? Or do you actually have that on?
He had that on.
Wow.
That was his.
Is that a Rob Ray shirt you had?
Rob Ray, one of my favorites.
So that was a segment from NHL Tonight on Halloween. I'm not sure what year it was, but it's really funny. It's Barry reading a bunch of kids in a Sabres jersey. Okay. It was a Rob Ray Sabres jersey, though, as he points out, which is kind of cool. But he was greeting the kid trick-or-treaters and in a hockey mask, kind of Jason-esque hockey mask, and making such what I found to just be really, really funny jokes about hockey then. And I just think it was a great clip to play because it really just shows what his sense of humor was on the air. But still kind of in the background, you're like, oh, those are some seriously interesting insights. So great thing, and you even get to hear the classic introduction there with him and Buchogross. Just takes me back, man. Awesome, awesome clip. But that's what I want to talk about here in the third period is Barry's career as a broadcaster. It's funny to think that including his playing time in the SJHL as a junior through his coaching stint in L.A., Melrose was in the game as a player or a coach for 22 years. But as a broadcaster, he's been on TV for 26 years. And to be honest, that's where most people know him from. And like I said, I remember him coaching the Kings, but I can say with confidence that that was the only an introduction to Barry. It's that life as a broadcaster that I wanted to discuss here in the final frame and the one that I remember him most and think of him the most as these days, as he is even still on ESPN today. As I've said in the past, as I said last period, it didn't take long for Barry to get the call to join ESPN. They wanted him on board to cover the playoffs that season, and from there, he's been a part of ESPN's hockey coverage for 26 years. He's quick to note that broadcasting is not something that's an easy transition for someone. He starts by explaining that while it's easy to be the interviewee, it's much harder to give the interview. You got to be aware of what the camera's on you. You got to make eye contact with the interviewee and making sure that you're not distracted by the producer telling you to wrap it up or even the teleprompter or anything else that's out there. He describes it as not being as easy as it looks. Barry found all that distracting at first and really kind of struggled until he just started to understand that if he spoke from the heart, spoke from those experiences that we've talked about before, that he would have a lot more success. He says that he learned that he's not good with teleprompters or notes, and they'd rather just speak off the top of his head, which you can kind of tell it comes through in his style, but I really appreciate it for one, and I think a lot of people do. I mean, now, it really explains a lot to me because that's the Melrose I know and probably explains why everything comes out with some wit and some good old-fashioned Saskatchewan logic. Barry's also quick to point out that his logic for comments on the air is simple, that he speaks from his multiple experiences in the game. As he puts it, he's been traded, sent down to the minors, coached, and made decisions for a club, so he takes that into account when asking questions to players, coaches, and GMs that he interviews, understanding that no one's perfect, and that he probably should just keep in mind that they've gone through something similar that he has. He also brings up something that I feel is essential to his philosophy, and he says that he never criticizes the person. He never criticizes the person. He just criticizes the act. As he puts it, there's nothing personal about sports. It's a business. Also, I believe that by doing that, Melrose is staying true to the idea that everyone makes mistakes and you can point them out, but it's never good policy to try to tear someone down at the expense of making yourself look good. Not to go too much on a tangent, but I think that happens a lot in the broadcasting business. And in the case of guys like Don Cherry, it's the reason that they start to look like cynical dinosaurs and eventually lose their grip on fans. I think it speaks directly to Barry's longevity in the sport and at the same time at the network for almost 26 years. Right here is the time I want to bring up a topic that I think needs to be covered when talking about Barry, which is a small interruption of his broadcast career to go into coaching again. Going into the 2008-2009 season, Barry had always been kind of thinking about for some time that he still had coaching in his blood, that he could probably still do it, and he wanted to possibly get a chance to prove it. He started to feel like his credibility was also starting to wane, and he was writing all the credibility that he did have was being used up, and like many coaches who go from broadcasting back into coaching, he decided it was time to get some recent experience and show they still had it and that he could be successful in the coaching business. What he thought was the right opportunity came along that year when the Tampa Bay Lightning changed owners, and that the new owner, Orin Coles, approached him in the summer of 08 and said that he wanted Barry to coach his team. Coles was a fan of the Kings style under Barry, and he felt that he was who he wanted to coach the Lightning going forward. So Barry signed on to the Lightning, but it was a marriage that only lasted for 15 games before Barry quit. The Lightning were not setting the world on fire at a 5-7-3 clip. But more importantly, Melrose felt like his style of coaching was no longer compatible with the game or with the new mentality of the players of the time. He points out that his biggest issue was that the players were too friendly with the owners. The issue was that when he tried to discipline a player, they complained to ownership, and ownership would side with the player rather than Barry. Barry basically got fed up with being put in between and decided it was best just to step aside rather than continue to try to reach players who really weren't buying into his system or his philosophy. As he puts it, you can't be their buddy and their coach at the same time. You can only be one. Luckily for Barry, his past work ethic and relationship with ESPN was great, and they had him back in the family by New Year's, only 2 months after quitting Tampa to cover the 2009 Winter Classic in the Big House in Michigan. He says he's totally committed to broadcasting now, as he says, quote, the nagging old desire to coach is gone for good. He just feels that, like, the game has passed him by and he's committed to the job that he might actually be better at, speaking from his mind about hockey. But most of all, though, Barry's small interlude back into coaching did something very important for him. He says that he's a better broadcaster for the experience and now really doesn't have to worry much about what he says. He points out that the feeling of not having to subconsciously be positioning for a job allows him to be unencumbered, and that's a good thing. Heck, I like it. I mean, that means there's going to be more down-to-earth blunt assessments by the man I've been hearing give him out ever since I was a teenager. So, not a bad thing, and he's definitely still doing that. I guess the way to end talking about Barry's sportscasting life would be that, while it's a total shame that ESPN has him on the margins because of the way they treat hockey as an afterthought, it's a pleasure to see that they've held on to him for so long. He seems to be one of the most liked analysts at ESPN and always has a fun time. It's always a fun time to see him and Bucci reunite for the NCAA tournament. It's the national platform on ESPN that he has, and I often think sometimes that he might be the state's version of Don Cherry. Before you get too crazy, Barry's a U.S. citizen now, so he's dual, and that's the best of both worlds. Still, it should be said that while Barry and Grapes offer no-nonsense old-school takes on hockey, Barry's the one that's still got a job, and virtually no one has had really anything ever bad to say about him. He's just a likable character. I mean, watch how he interacts with his cohorts at ESPN. It's a good thing. And I think that just says a lot about the man and what he stands for and what he's done with his broadcasting career and in his life. So that's all for the third period. Let's go ahead and wrap this thing up in the postgame.
Tell the people the great night you had against the French Connection when those guys lit you up.
How do you remember all my stories?
Oh, I know them all. I read your book. That's all
okay.
I know.
So and it's still available on Amazon.
Playing $1.50.
Playing in Buffalo. Okay. No, actually, I'm going to go back. I'm going to tell you the whole story. We played the night before in Toronto, and they beat us 6-1. Like, this Buffalo had a great team. They had Danny Gare. This is a team that, you know, went to Stanley Cup.
King Cora.
Yeah, and they had the French Connection. So in Toronto, they beat us 6-2. You know, they were just a better team than us. So we go to Buffalo, and we could beat 14-4. And the funny part was, like, I couldn't say this, but I thought I played really well.
Wait a second. You lost 14-4, and you thought you played very well.
I must have had 5 big hits. I think I was in a fight that night. Right. And I must have blocked, like, 7 shots. And the funny part was, it wasn't just me. The next day at practice, Dan Maloney comes up to me and says, Barry, I thought you played really well.
You sure he wasn't sarcastic?
No!
He wasn't kidding.
No, like, I was just sitting on the bench.
Right.
You know, I know we got beat 14-4, but I think I played pretty well. And then Danny came up to me next day. He said, Barry, we got our butt foot, but I thought you played a really good game. So, it was -5, I think. But everyone is -5 or 6.
14.
So they scored 20 goals on us in 2 games.
How many times Perot walk around here?
When you played,
were not on the ice against the French Connection line.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to be.
Yeah.
So what you do, you never get in position to get beat. I really never left the crossbar in our own end. If he was going to score, it was going to be a shot. I wasn't going to meet him at the blue line and let him walk around me. So I knew, and then I ended up playing with Rene Robert in Cincinnati. And obviously Martin, Ricky Martin. That was the best line in the world when that line was together. That line was just scary sick.
Okay, so that was another segment with Levy and Barry about Barry losing 14-1 to the then French Connection line, Buffalo Sabres. I thought that was too funny to hear that story about him and Dan Maloney saying, you know, that he played good in that game, even though the Maple Leafs got their butts kicked. So once again, just a good example of good old Melrose humor mixed in with some great hockey stories, and that's just what makes a man special. So, in to start the post game here, I just want to say there's plenty more to this book other than just Barry's life, and I hope you take a moment to read that too. The end of the book has just got a ton of awesome thoughts on the game and some of the people who have been in it. And I'd love to cover it all on the show, but I'm pretty sure that you're already getting tired of hearing me talk, so I'll spare you. But when you do pick the book up, definitely make sure you don't gloss that over, because it's a great part of the book. Still, why I went over Barry's story the way I did is because it's a little different than the ones we've talked about thus far on the show. It just seemed to me that, like Barry's hockey road, that Barry's hockey road was unique and has led to his unique view on the game. Being a minor leaguer struggling just to get NHL playing time and doing whatever he had to make it gives him an air of humility, while at the same time it makes him appreciate the bevy of NHL players who might play night in and night out that aren't always on the one-way contracts making over $1 million a season. Basically, he knows the plight of everybody, not just the superstars. That was Barry when he played. He played, and it comes through in his ability to spot hard work and fundamentals. And he had to concentrate on that. So it's just easy for him to spot that solid hockey, those fundamentals. And that's what made him a good coach, too. Also, it's fun to talk about his coaching rise as well. If you learned anything from Barry's coaching stories, it's that it's easy to coach the game. It's hard to reach the players. When he did his best coaching in junior and the AHL, he was mentoring young players and letting them know the hard lessons that he had learned as a player who didn't have everything handed to him. I guess that's why he did so much better in the lower leagues and because he could build relationships with those players. His record as an NHL coach isn't that great, and that might speak to the fact that he couldn't reach those players as easily because they didn't need or want to listen to what Barry had to offer. They were already established. They didn't need to know the way. But those players in junior and the AHL certainly could benefit from Barry's advice. Still, we all benefit now from the fact that the NHL players didn't take to his style of coaching, because we all now get to hear what he has to offer. And I'm not sure about you, but I'd like to hear the simple logic from the prairies that is mixed in with the experience of playing and coaching with nothing coming easy. Oh, and his sense of humor is awesome because of it, too. So, if you think about it, had he been a better coach, would he have gotten into broadcasting? Would we know him quite the way we do now? I don't think so. So, yeah, you need to go read Dropping the Gloves when you get a moment. As we've talked about, Barry's life story in hockey, it's a good one. But what makes this book special is that at every turn he takes a life story and then adds on a lesson about the game. If he's describing his coaching days in the WHL, he spends more time explaining how it is to coach teenagers and junior than he does explaining the particulars of the Memorial Cup that he won. To me, that's really the genius of the book. You get Barry Melrose commentary set to the backdrop of his life and memories, as opposed to just straight hearing a story. You get some extra thoughts. Also, like I said in the warm-up, this is an easy read. 230 pages of text that go by quickly with no pretentious wording. That's awesome. Add to that, as well, many of the hockey books that I've read, sometimes they seem to get bogged down in the details, but this book really does not. Barry gets in and out with his thoughts. No overly detailed stories here. It just seems like every thought is just the right amount of detail. It's a really underrated part of the book, and one I think you'll clue into if you read it. And finally, since it was published in 2012, it's a little dated on some things, but I'd say it's all still relevant. It's all still a very relevant read, as the lessons that he learned throughout his life are still very valid to players and coaches today. So go out and pick it up. You'll laugh and you'll just have a lot of fun with this book. I promise you. So definitely go get it. Okay, so that's the end of this tilt. And I just want to say, as always, I want to thank you for stopping by and listening. I mean, honestly, it's awesome. It's fun to take this dive into another great hockey book with you. So I hope you'll join me again. It's really a fun time for me, and I hope it has been for you the same. So if you like what you've heard, please give me a subscribe on your favorite podcast listening type place. And also give the podcast some love on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where I post daily facts about the subject of this week's episode. If you haven't already gotten on, please do. And for those of you who were on last week, you could have won a Bobby Orr card, but nobody seemed to enter the contest. So if you're listening now, I'm going to give away a Melrose card this week. So if you're following Twitter, you can have a chance to win that. So look us up on Twitter and follow us, and you can win yourself a Barry Melrose hockey card. And so with that, I just want to start the preview of looking ahead to next week's book. We're going to get ready to do what I think is one of my favorite books. Probably, if I had to put a number on it, it's definitely a top five. Definitely a top five. And truly one of the best and most comprehensive books written on what I call a special time in the game of hockey, a professional hockey. So tune in next week when the subject of our show is going to be the book Rebel League, The Short and Unruly Story of the World Hockey Association by Ed Willis. So till then, take care. Thank you very much for tuning in, and stay classy, hockey fans. Adios.